why most of the people that build these things, that build good ones, insulate them with Teflon. So it really depends on what you're doing with the balun. If you're using the balun on frequencies and mismatches, that you shouldn't be doing, you may end up with some problems with high power. Probably not with 300 or 400 watts. You could probably use it. And as you remember, we took apart that Radio Works balun that had the core cracked. Still can't figure out what the guy did to that. And yes, I was quite surprised to see that it was not wound with Teflon wire, because most of the ones, the good ones, are wound with Teflon. Back to that.
So let me ask a question. If the core is cracked, what does that do? As long as the core is physically, you know, mechanically together, even if it's cracked through and follows its position in a cohesive manner, what does that yield you or cost you?
Well, in this case, the core was crumbled, it cracked and it was open, so it was not working the way it was supposed to. Actually, it would work at low power, but once you get up to high power, you start seeing the SWR go up.
Okay, very good. So it was no longer maintaining any kind of form.
It was in 100-something pieces. There was no way I could glue the thing back together even.
Okay, good to know. All right. So the side lesson there is that a few hundred watts, sure, you can get away with the household wiring. And the other side lesson is that, yes, if the core is coming apart, as long as it maintains some of its mechanical structure, even if it's broken, it's compromised, as long as you can kind of, with baling wire and epoxy, keep it together, it'll be fine, again, as long as it doesn't get heated up and, you know, due to higher power and causing it to lose form, and then you're back to bad things and away you go again.
Well, basically I'm doing Hawaii Radio Club instead of on that little tiny car. I'm using the 300-2s, and they're going to cost me about $9 a piece, and I'm going to consider them disposable. If they get stuck, if they get broken, if they get lost, like, who cares? I got 6 of them.
Okay, very good. So that way you can launch them into the trees and not care. What are you going to do about your coax if you lose that? Or I guess you're feeding it from the base, so the coax is, you know, accessible at all times. You're basically treating this thing like an inverted triangle, right?
No, this is an end-fed dipole.
And I am actually just shipped over to Mr. Joyce's house. Believe it or not, 26-inch dog tennis ball throwers, a couple different versions, along with 18 tennis balls, and we're going to see if we can get those up in a tree safely, because if I'm in a campground, nobody's going to complain if I'm playing ball with my dog. They may, however, complain if I shoot an arrow in the air and it comes down through the roof of their camper. They may complain if I launch one of those pieces of wood with a 16-penny nail in it that goes 400 feet, or perhaps if I use Mr. Joyce's dill pickle launcher, it will launch a dill pickle 500 feet. Some of those things may not go over well in a campground. However, a tennis ball with an arm launcher may probably would not raise comment.
Jim?
Okay. The thing that, it's K2ZO, the thing that he's talking about was recently written up in QST. And basically what it consists of is a handle with a long, flexible piece on it made of plastic and a cup. Now what you do is you put a tennis ball in there and you whip this thing up in the air. Now if you looked at the article in QST, I believe that's where I saw it, a guy took one of those and then what he did is he lashed a spinning reel to it. and then took the ball and put a piece of wire, poked the two holes in it, ran a piece of wire through that, made a loop of that so you could tie the monofilament line on it, and that's the way he was launching the antennas. I'm going to drop a second. Okay, the antenna that Noel was talking about is a very interesting antenna. It does work. I know Steve, WI2W, and I talked on 75 meters, and he was down there in Maryland running 100 watts with one, and it loads up no problem at all. And what it consists of is a 9-to-1 balun and a N-fed antenna. Now, you have to pick particular lengths where it'll work on a number of bands. And there's a little bit of discussion on that, but it turns out that 53 feet, 124 feet are pretty good lengths. I'll drop it again. Okay, and what the idea is, this is a simple, easy-to-use antenna. It consists of a piece of coax of a random length going up to a 9-to-1 balun. Now, the balun is a transformer balun. It uses not ferrite, but powdered iron. In other words, number 2 permeability material, the red core. And you wind it. It's pretty easy to wind. You take 3 trifilar windings. You put them in series, and you put your 50 ohms across one-third of it. So basically, it's a step-up 9-to-1. And it hits the high impedance at the end of the thing and matches it, and off you go. And if you pick the right length, and you pick the right length of coax, as Steve did on his, we had it at Kitnight, and he was able to tune it up on pretty much any band just with the tuner and the radio. And it does work. Works quite well. So Noel is planning to make a bunch of them. My disagreement with the group that originally started selling these things is that they say to use a 30-foot piece of wire, and I can't think and reason that out. It turns out that if you look at the Balun Designs website, you'll see that they do the same thing, and they say a minimum of 54 feet. Back to that, K2ZO.
Yeah, and I had one of those antennas that was made, what the hell they call the Una something or other, anyway. I extended the wire to about 53 feet, so I would agree, Jim. The question, do you find a need for a decoupling loop right under the balun, or, and how critical is the coax length?
Once you get 50 feet or so of coax, you're okay, and you usually should have some decoupling at the coax, because in reality, this thing is going to be using a shield at a coax for a counterpoise. So you want to put at least some kind of a line isolator at the radio. Otherwise, you may have some problems. Of course, you could get away with putting another piece of wire on the ground as a counterpoise. But I found with that, and also with the off-center fed antennas, especially the 20% off-center fed, that you do need some kind of a line isolator somewhere in that line. Now, I actually experimented and found that you could put it on the radio itself, but actually it worked better right underneath the original balun. And I made a line isolator with just one core, wound 10 turns on it, and used it that way. Found it was much more efficient doing it up there than doing it down for the off-center fed antenna. For the N-fed, the one that Noel is just talking about, you want it down at the bottom because you're actually using some of the feed line as a radiating element. Back to that.
Okay, so that's good to know. And so if you're treating it like a any kind of center, off-center fed dipole, you put the line isolator at the top. And if you are doing an N-fed, like with the 9-to-1 balun, because you're using the coax as a counterpoise, essentially, put it at the radio or in the proximity of the radio. In fact, what you may want to do is take an additional section of, if you don't have a line isolator, you could always take 100 feet of coax and maybe 25 feet from the radio, spin up 25 feet of it into a coil, and 50 feet goes northbound to the antenna, and 25 feet goes southbound to the radio, and that would meet that same objective. Similarly, with the OCF or center-fed dipoles, you could take 25 feet of cable and coil it up underneath the ballon, or underneath the feed point, as the case may be, if you don't have a ferrite-based line isolator. Any thoughts, Jim?
And we were using RG8X and found that about 10 turns, about 8 inches in diameter, held together with some tape or whatever, was really all you needed on HF. And that was enough to keep anything off. Because especially when you start fooling around with an off-center fed, that's a 2080. Even though you've got a good tight current ballon, you can still get some unbalance. And it, depending on your radio, it can show up. And of course, it, depending on the power. Now, if you run 100 watts, a lot of times you won't see a problem. But if you run 1,000 watts, then you might see it. RF in your audio or stuff like that. So it's good to isolate any type of an antenna like that that's off-center fed, and especially an end fed. But a end fed, you have to realize that part of the antenna ends up being that piece of feed line. So you want to move that isolator down, back to net.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. 50 feet from the attachment point of the coax is where you should probably think about putting that. And, you said 8-inch loops, about 10 of them, make a good line isolator with RG8X. That's good stuff. I will tell you that a portable situation I was doing in April, that I actually cheerfully, even though my dipole was in the center, probably 30 feet in the air, it was, a slightly droopy V, so maybe the edges were maybe 15 feet in the air. The lazy V, if you will. And it was a center-fed 40-meter dipole, and my 7000 really, really, really liked the line isolator, which I did not have a coiled loop at the feed point, so I was able to just insert the line isolator immediately outside the radio box, and that was sufficient to keep the radio from resetting, on 40 meters. So. Sure. Was there another station that wanted to make a comment? K2B Air. Okay, Jim, it's back to you, and I think we'll go to the next question after you.
Okay, that's it. No more other comments, and I will be testing a line isolator that I built for Noel, probably on field day. So we'll be reporting on that one. Back to net, K2ZO.
Any more from you? Okay, very good. All right, Howie, I think you said it was W2CNN. Was that the call sign?
I must have wrote it down wrong. LCN, LCN, K2EIR. And I'm going to go to sleep after this.
Okay, it's Mr. Rick, W2LCN, K2BAR. Go ahead, Rick.
Hey, Chris, I'll give you a quick update. Kids are doing well. The big brother is stepping back from his role, allowing the other big brother, the little one, to step in and be a big brother to his little sister, which is kind of cool. The question I have for you is this. I had one of those routers that was no good for the HSSM mesh. So what I did was I flashed it with DD Wart, and it's actually pretty cool. I like the I like the whole layout. I haven't began to play with it, but it is really neat. It really changes what you can do with the router. One of the things that I saw was you are able to change the output. So it goes from 71 milliwatts all the way up to 250 milliwatts, 71 being the default. When we're working with the HSM mesh nodes, what is the output power? I was a little surprised to find that Linksys by default sets it at only 71 milliwatts instead of the 250 or cranking it up a little bit. What are we outputting when we're using the output on HSM mesh, and how did it work on field day? So two questions there. Send it back to Ned. This is W2LPN.
Okay, so the first question is power related. Well, I think it's 19 dBm is the highest they let you, and that's not 250 milliwatts. That would be, let's see, if it was 20 dBm, it would be 200 milliwatts. Is that, no, 100 milliwatts. 100 milliwatts? Is that right? Yeah, 120 dBm is 100 milliwatts. So, it's probably in the 79 range. I am a little surprised that the box lets you go higher. What we might want to do to experiment with that is take one of the other boxes that we've already put on the mesh, reflash it with DDWRT, and see what power options it gives you. The other question is that indication for real? Does it take into account the build type, you know, the model number, or is that just a paper tiger? So if you set it to a power level higher than what it can do, it'll just give you what it gives you, and that's that. That's a really good question. I don't know. But I thought it was around 79 milliwatts, in all honesty. I think that's what 19 dBm is, roughly speaking, if I remember my logarithms. Let's get to that one, and then restate your second question, if you don't mind.
All right, that sounds that's helpful. I saw a couple of guys on YouTube who had been putting out information about the DD Wart, and one of the things they said was one of the guys had been running it for gaming, and he cranked it all the way up to 200 milliwatts, and it has been running there for, you know, 3 or 4 years. Yeah, that's fine. I'm not too sure. They said the default from Linksys is set at 71 milliwatts. But at any rate, I guess my second question is beside me right now. I don't remember what it was. I forget what it is. It's getting late, and I kind of lost track. This is W2LPN. I'll send it back over to you. If I think about it, I'll put it back out there.
Was it about the camera?
Thank you. No, it wasn't about the camera, but how did the results of the parade go in Fairlawn when you were running the parade route? I didn't hear any information on how things went. I did look as the vehicles went by, and I wanted to see if it popped up on my phone on the Wi-Fi, but any comment from anybody on how that test went?
I will defer to Gary on this one. KD2DDK, K2BAR.
KD2DDK. Yeah, hi, Eric. From one point of view, I would say that it went very well as far as the mesh nodes. If I was to grade it, I'd give us about a 60. Real quick, we really didn't know what we were doing until about a half hour before the parade kickoff. We threw one of the cameras in one of the cars that was at the end of the parade. Unfortunately, it ended up one of the vehicles at the end or towards the end of the parade. That gave us like roughly 20 minutes to set up a string of mesh nodes to do something. And we got three down the road, and the nodes were valuable. We could log into that second camera. Only there was something going on there. There was a power problem with the second camera. We could log into it, but we couldn't get any video out of it. In the meantime, when the car in the parade got within range of the nodes, The nose picked him up, and he transmitted video piece of cake until he left the range of the nose, which was pretty cool. So, you know, from that, there was a whole mess of other little things going on, but that's the crux of it. So I give us, you know, we're good for what we had time to do.
Gary, here's a question for you. Were you already in the mode of getting video, or should we say polling for video, and waiting for the nose to sync up, or were you constantly manually retrying to connect to that camera as the camera's node approached your mesh node?
That's a question for Carl. I was stringing the nodes down the parade route backwards, so I ended up down at the last, I was the last node on the parade route. Carl was the one back with the PC and whatever he was doing. But I know once it passed me, Carl was on the air saying he's got picture from our access point 2 or whatever, which was halfway down. Like, it bypassed me before it synced up and it caught onto the second node. But I don't know. That would be a question for Carl.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think what we need is a persistent client that goes and tries to do that. I think we still have some work to do on the server side. I'm thinking about it more and more. I'd like to marry the camera up with a Raspberry Pi, and then have the Raspberry Pi distribute to a set of pre-registered addresses, and stream those frames. And if those addresses are not on the mesh at that time, they'll just basically be discarded. No big deal. A more advanced technique would be to multicast it and just basically have a bunch of clients on the mesh looking for the multicast addresses. We haven't tried, subnet 10 multicasting, but that's something that over the next couple of months I hope to be able to bring back to the team through some other work I'm working on. I should be able to do that without any proprietary issues. I think we'll be in fine shape. But I like Rick's idea of exploring this power issue. I think one of the things we need to do is take one of the existing mesh nodes and see what happens when we put DDWRT on there. Will it actually let us manipulate power differently? Or is the numeric value on the screen just, in a word, BS? Anyway, anything else anybody want to ask about this?
Real quick, I have flashed a couple of DDWRTs. Based on the newer versions that we can't use in the MSH mode. How are we going to do the power measurement? Did anybody figure out a valid way to do that yet?
Hey, B2LCS.
Good, Rick.
You had given me a piece of software at one point in time, I think, that showed what the Wi-Fi signals were. And I actually turned mine up. I didn't know what I was doing, so I didn't go above about 100, which isn't a lot of difference between 71 and 100 milliwatts. But I did notice when I ran my laptop with that program looking at the Wi-Fi signals, even though I was very close, I saw at one point in time the DDWRT spiked up higher and stayed there, opposed to the other Linksys router, which is, I'm actually getting the Wi-Fi off of, and it actually spiked up just a little higher, and I've never seen them rise above whatever it was. I think it was I think they listed it 35, if I remember. I don't even know how it was listed, but I was going by the height of the bar graph that was on the bottom, and at one point, when I made the adjustment just a little bit, it showed just a little bit of increase in power over my Wi-Fi router. So I don't know if that's a way that we could look at it, but that's how I did it to see if it actually did work, and it looked like it did. But like you said, I don't know if it's just a gimmick or if it's actually putting out more power.
Well, the relative signal amplitude is, in fact, shown in Wi-Fi Scanner. Wi-Fi Scanner is an Android app. So sure, why not? It's not an absolute power measurement, but it'll tell you whether or not you're goosing the juice. I'd like to see this done, though, with mesh-enabled devices, what are called the older devices, and see what happens when we put DWRT on those. Do we get a difference? That's kind of what I'm getting at here. Anyway, I may have some momentary chaos in a few moments when James gets in the car. So just as a heads up to everybody, I may be a little distracted. So if that happens, just my apologies in advance. Let's see what else. Any other comments, Gary?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You should probably have answered your phone. James has been trying to call you. He's looking for you. And so SWA.
Oh, I see the problem. The phone's not ringing. Hold on.
KD2DDK, Y Gordon Fizzy. I'm thinking RF connect, inline connections and watt meters and stuff that will handle that frequency. We got RSSI stuff on my Android. To set up a valid distance test and do some benchmarking before we play. Yeah, you know what? I already have these boxes flashed. I'm gonna play with them too. So we see what happens. My main reason for flashing them was I wanted to see if one could see the other and get them to talk intranetwork, like a bridge.
I'm sorry, Gary, I missed that. What was that?
That's all right. I was just filling in while you were getting your phone turned on or whatever. I was saying, I'm thinking bird watt meter type RF connection for the power measurement. The RSSI stuff is great. You know, I got it on the Android. Just set up a benchmark in distance and, see if there's a difference. The main reason I did the EDWRT was to see if I could get it to bridge over to the mesh and be able to run both, depending on the situation, and keep them bridged.
Yeah, very good. Very good. That's a good thing. But one of the things I think we want to do is take one of these older devices and figure out whether or not they actually have the higher power capability using DWRT. I think that's probably a good idea. So if you have the time, go ahead and flash it and run Wi-Fi scanner and see if you see a difference as you change the value.
I've got two flashed already. I've been playing with the bridging stuff not all week. I think the last time I played was Tuesday or something. But I've already got two of the version 8 and the version 6 flashed over to EDWRT.
Yeah, but those are newer boxes. What I'm trying to say is get a box that's like a version 3, something that only worked where the mesh would work, and retro to DWRT and see if you have the capability of adjusting power on those boxes.
Cranking up the power and then flashing it back? Okay. Yeah, I like that idea.
No, that's another step. Hold on. What I'm saying is, take a mesh node, flash it with DDWRT, adjust the power level with DDWRT to see if you actually can get more than the 70 whatever it is milliwatts out of the older boxes. That's what I'm getting at.
Oh yeah, no, we caught that, and what I was getting at is if I do, I will leave it at the higher power level and then go back to the mesh side and see if it stays.
Now, see, I don't think it's going to do that because I think what happens is it re-zeroes all the values when you load the next set of software in.
Yeah, but if the mesh software doesn't handle power, maybe it's not even going to mess with those zeros.
Yeah, well, it's a different memory map, so it's going to gut whatever is in DDWRT and overlay it with the memory map of HSMM mesh
and we already know that we can't go above, I think, 19 dBm with HSM and mesh for some reason. And we're not sure if for real we can go over that with legacy boxes with DWRT.
Okay, we're thinking ahead. Yeah. All right, yeah. No, all right, we can do that, yeah. I follow what you want to do, and you're right. You're right. It's a whole... It's a firmware upgrade. I'm not just swapping programs.
There you go. Exactly. It's not like they have a common set of registers that stay static when you go from one software to the other. Which it were so, but don't think so. In fact, no so. That's in fact not the case. Cool idea, though. That would be an interesting idea to have a platform agnostic control block that would not get overridden. You go from one software to the other, unless you did, you know, unless you forced it to crash or something, you know, it did the reset hold thing. All right. Anybody else with comments about mesh cameras, etc.?
Casey, do you have it?
Mr. Paul.
Yeah, just a quick question on the PAR. Sort of comes back to something that we did at the Hamfest. If these things are pumping out 78 milliwatts, when you stuck the PAR meter on the actual the node itself, it was pulling down about 2 watts. Where's the rest of the PAR going?
There's a CPU in there, and it wasn't just that. I was pulling a second router and a cell data card, too.
Okay. I just sort of, you know, at some point I just want to put a solar on this. You know, if I can get away with the smaller panels, you know, would actually like to go more that way. So it's more a case of, you know, how much I actually need to power these guys.
I will get you a number for the power consumption of a standard HSMM mesh, like using like a GL, like one of the units that we got through Rick. I'll get you that information, and I'll try to do that tomorrow and send it to you. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Back to that.
FYI, I will not be at the Fairlawn Club tomorrow night. I will be either on my way to or in Pennsylvania. For a hockey weekend with Mr. Jeremy, so I extend my regrets, but shamelessly so. But I'll see you guys next week over at the Fairlawn Club. I recommend you get together anyway, have fun. But I'll try to get you that information. I'll send it to you and Gary and Carl. I should be able to do that in a matter of a couple of minutes, sitting at my desk while, you know, doing other things. I can just slap one of those power monitoring devices on and get you that value in a heartbeat just by booting up a node on a pigtail. So I will do that for you, Paul. Anybody else? All right, very good. Anybody else have any questions? Do we have any outstanding questions or comments that we did not get to tonight? Please call K2BA or WQGTT.
KC2UN here.
Mr. Paul.
Yeah, I just got one question. Bit of a newbie question. When I'm looking at my power supply, when I hit my tuner, I get probably about just under 10 amps draw as it tunes up. Then when I actually key down to actually transmit, I'm still drawing around the same 10 amps. My question is that normal, or do I have an issue? I don't think I have an issue with my finals because, you know, on the 10 meter net I'm actually getting out. I'm just wondering what should I really be looking at on a draw at, say, 100 watts on 10 meters?
You're pulling northbound of 100 watts power, which, you know, I guess is about right. You know, you know, you might want to check your drive to see if your drive is set up to somewhere less than 100%. You have an ICOM radio?
Yeah, I've got a 7000, so just using the quick set and, you know, setting that up to 100.
Okay, depending on how it's set up and what tuner you're using, you may be setting up at high power, but I'm wondering off the top of my head whether or not you're actually, I would go check the CW tune and the SSB positions, SSB power levels, because they're expressed as a percentage of 100, and you might want to check that. In that radio it's not that way, it's by band. So you've got VHF, UHF, and HF, if I remember right, power out percentages. So I think you can check that by simply, checking the menus and making sure they're at 100.
Okay, that gives me somewhere to go. KC2UN, here's back to them.
Yeah, by the way, one of my projects, not for this weekend, but for next week, is to finally, after 3 years of bitching about it, I'm going to take my 7000, which you know is in that wonderful case. I'm going to remove the front panel from the radio, turn the radio around on the bracket, and make the front panel of the radio autonomous so that you can slide it out and put it on your desk somewhere else, along with a secondary matching speaker. I'm going to kind of redo that whole thing. I'm going to redo the lower part. So if the lower part's removable with a pair of wing nuts, you just unsnap it, and the front panel of the radio is going to be on a little metal plate with one of the speakers, and I have to decide what to do with the other speaker and the other radio. That's a whole other matter. But that's kind of where I'm going with that. It should be interesting. The other thought I had was to repackage it into a smaller box entirely, but I think for other reasons I'm not going to do that. But we'll see. Anyway, anybody else? K2BAR. Okay, I'd just like to thank Howie, K2EIR, and Gary, KD2DDK, in particular for their help tonight running the net. What you guys probably may or may not have picked up on is that Howie was describing a list of who had what way of comments and questions and such for the net, because I was operating mobile tonight. And in order to facilitate picking up James, who's here now, welcome back, Mr. James. KC2SQV is now in Jersey. And then Gary met me for to return some components borrowed for the parade. And in that process, hung with me over where we rendezvoused, and also helped manage the net about the time that Noel was asking his question and making his comments. So, again, thank you to both of you gentlemen. I also want to thank everybody for participating tonight, and wish everybody a fine good evening. Have a great weekend. Stay cool. And play radio this weekend. It's going to be a nice warm weekend, so get some shade, get outside and play radio. Go out on the deck. Go out on the patio. Go out in the yard. Go to the park. Go to the mobile. And open up the windows, get out of the car, play radio. It's fun. That's what we did tonight, by the way. Part of the night tonight, we had the radio up on top of the car. So that was awesome. 7-3, everybody, and thanks to Chestnut Ridge Radio Club for the Easter repeater. God bless. K2BAR, off and clear, W2TGT.
November Yankee 2 Echo Echo.
NY2EEK2MIJ. You there, Joe?
That's funny. I keyed up 20 meters to answer you. So, go ahead. NY2EE.
Yeah, how you doing, Joe? Yeah, I did that the other night myself. I was sitting here with the foot switch, and I was, as I was talking on the machine here, I was I was talking at the same time through the headset on 20 meters. They probably thought I was nuts. Anyway, I got your text. What's the difference between the 6500 and the 6700? The only thing I could see was maybe a little bit of faster processor speed, and the fact that the 6700, I think, I don't know if it transmits VHF, but it seems to receive. Is that the only difference?
From what I think the difference is, what they call slices, you know how I see on the pan adapter, I'm looking at a spectrum from right now. I'm looking at 14170 to 205, I'm sorry. And I'm looking at the signals that are popping up all over the place. What that does is the 65 takes four of these chunks of band, and it could be you could be talking on 20, and you can be looking at 80, and you can be looking at 40, and you can be looking at 30, just for an example. On the 65 only allows you to do that four times. The 67 allows you to do it eight times. But from what I'm dealing with right now, just this one is enough for me. You know, I can do that. Right now, I can look at this band and go to another band on the other receiver if I wanted to. I have the two receivers in here. So if I wanted to listen to 40 and transmit on 20, I can do that. But these seem to be... Also, the other difference is it's not Power SDR anymore. It's some kind of client software that they have, and you have to pay for it. For upgrades, I mean, you know, it's like $199 a year. So that's how they're going to make that money. So obviously, they weren't very profitable with the Power SDR, but that's what this new trick is all about. But I don't know if I want to go into it. And as far as the 67, I don't think I need to look at eight bands at one time. You know what I'm saying? That's a little bit much. It's a little spread me out a little bit too much. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree. I think being able to see four slices is more than enough. I don't know what the difference price-wise is. I mean, I don't know. Do you have the 6500 now? Is that what you have? And the 67 is the newer model. If you got four band slices, I don't know why. I mean, how many bands do you want to look at? I mean, are you going to be deaf? Yeah, I could see that if you were a big contester or something like that, where you might find a rare DX station. Say if you're operating all bands, you see a massive amount of activity on a some frequency at 40 or something, and at the same time, you know, six other bands, you could jump around, but I don't see any need for it. I think four slices is plenty for just casual operating. I don't see why you would need more than that. And I guess with the client software or what they had, I know they had issues with it as far as CW was.